This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Film, stage, and television director Arthur Penn died Tuesday night in New York. He was 88. He directed the films The Miracle Worker, Alice's Restaurant, Little Big Man, Night Moves, and Missouri Breaks. And he advised John Kennedy in his 1960 TV debates with Richard Nixon. But Penn is best remembered for the 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde, whose explicit violence, sex, and sympathetic portrayal of two criminals affected American filmmaking for years to come. Here's a scene from Bonnie and Clyde, the story of two young criminals robbing small-town banks during the Depression. The couple, played by Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, are taking leave of Bonnie's mother before they hit the road.
You know, Clyde, I read about you all in the papers, and I just get scared.
Now, Miss Parker, don't you believe what you read in all them newspapers? That's the law talking there. They want us to look big, so they're going to look big when they catch us. And they ain't going to catch us, because I'm even better at running than I am at robbing banks. Shoot, if we'd done half that stuff they say we'd done them papers, we'd be millionaires by now, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Huh? Look, I ain't going to risk my little girl here just to make money, uncertain as times are. Well, I know of a job. You remember time when we could have done $2,000 just as easy as pie. And I pulled up outside there and I saw them laws. And I said to myself, I said, Bonnie could get her chair. So we just drove right on and I let that money lay.
Maybe you know the way with her then. I'm just an old woman and
Ms.
I
Parker.
Don't know nothing.
But Miss Parker, this here is the way we know best how to make money. But we're going to be quitting all this as soon as the hard time's over. I can tell you that.
That's a scene from Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn. He spoke to Terry in 1989. The film's final scene, in which lawmen find and gun down Bonnie and Clyde, is one of the most memorable in American cinema.
I want to go back to 1967 when you made Bonnie and Clyde, which was really a landmark film in part because of how you handled the violence in it, particularly the scene at the end where Bonnie and Clyde each take dozens of bullets and their bodies twitch with the impact long after they're dead. This film led Pauline Kael to say, Penn has a gift for violence. Despite all the violence in movies, a gift for violence is rare. Did you think of yourself that way, as having that gift?
No, I wouldn't have defined it that way, but I guess you have to understand that we were operating, of course, in a totally different social context in those days. It was in the midst of the Vietnamese War, and daily news, the news of that we saw on television, had body counts and numbers of soldiers wounded and dead. And it was a time where it seemed to me that if we were going to depict violence, that we would be obliged, really, to depict it accurately with the kind of terrible, frightening volume that one sees when one genuinely is confronted by violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did in Bonnie and Clyde. Also, we were doing it at the same time with a kind of, at the end of the film, with an attempt to raise these two characters to a kind of faintly mythic proportion. So it was done in an extraordinarily complicated technical way, but the end result was to sort of propel them upward into myth, and that was the attempt, at least. And to some degree, I think we succeeded. We also succeeded in upsetting an awful lot of people.
Yeah. Can I ask you how you choreographed and shot that last sequence where Bonnie and Clyde are murdered with dozens of bullets?
Yes, but I'm afraid it'll be hopelessly technically difficult, but let me try and give you a short volume answer, okay?
Oh, please, yeah.
All right. One of the things that I attempted to do was to have it in different speeds. And the way you achieve slow motion in film is by actually running the film faster so that many more frames are exposed. And that's what produces slow motion. So the intention there was to get this kind of spastic motion of genuine violence at the same time the attenuation of time that one experiences when you see something like a terrible automobile accident or, in my case, certain occurrences in the war. It was this extraordinary stretch of time while these events were taking place. And so what I did was I ganged four cameras together, all running at different speeds, some at very, very, very high speed, and some at just double normal speed, some at four times normal speed. It was to get this kind of spastic, balletic violence. That was really the attempt, to really join time and space. And that's how we did it, in layman's terms, without getting into the technical aspects of it too deeply.
Now, I was just running back that scene last night on my VCR, and I think the part where you really see the slowed-down action is just when Warren Beatty takes the first bullet and falls to the ground.
You were aware of it there, but it runs all the way through the scene. It's all done in different time motions,
mm-hmm.
all the way through to the very end of the scene, including Faye falling in the car and her hands slowly bouncing, and then stopping.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was done by these four cameras in different speeds.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the sound of the bullet sounds like it's real time.
Exactly. We kept that, I decided to do it at a visual expansion of time and an auditory continuum of time in normal, apparently normal extension of time.
What, for disorientation?
No, actually, for orientation. I thought if we disoriented the sound as well as we disoriented the film, that we would then be clearly engaged in the movie aspect of it. And I didn't want you particularly to be aware of the medium at that point. I was hoping that you would be caught totally by the nature of the action on the screen.
Was there a code in existence at the time that you made Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, yes.
What did the code say about violence, and did you have any problem getting the film through? Because for its time, it was extreme.
No, may I try to correct a couple of things?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Yeah, first of all, it was not extreme. What it was that it became a cause célèbre because the critic at that time of the New York Times had decided to engage in a campaign against what he perceived as violence in films. And he was really objecting to many other kinds of films. When this came along, however, it provided him with the perfect launching pad for a real diatribe against our film and violence in film. And somehow we remained tainted with that. Now, he's talking about one kind of violence. Pauline Kael is talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Pauline Kael's kind of violence that I'm really responding to with as feeling it accuracy and complementary, because there's gratuitous mindless violence, and then there is the depiction of how it really is, and I think that we depicted that by not doing it in an ordinary reportorial style. God knows we've been imitated thousands and thousands of times now by television shows. Every time you see kind of somebody attempting violence, they go into that basic slow motion. Well, in American films, at least, we did it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about Kael here. Let me quote her again. She says that you put the sting back in death.
Well, as I say, in a context of the times, where we were seeing it on the 6 o'clock news all over the country, bodies, helicopters crashing, people being killed, young men being rushed to the ambulances, there was a kind of desensitization in the nation to violence. And it seemed to us, to me, that it was important to depict it as it really is.
You fought in World War II.
Yes.
Were there images that stayed with you that influenced the way you've handled violence in your films?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little?
Well, they just simply were images. They were images mostly during the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them, and they were terrifying.
Were you injured yourself?
No. I was very fortunate. I wasn't really engaged in much action at all. But what little bit of action I saw was more action than I ever want to see again.
Mm-hmm.
Director Arthur Penn speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1989 interview with director Arthur Penn, who died Tuesday at the age of 88.
Can we go back to 1958, to your first film, The Left-Handed Gun, which
Please.
Starred Paul Newman? And this was a psychological interpretation of the Billy the Kid story. How did you feel about making your movie debut in a Western that was going to be a new type of take on the genre?
Well, I felt rather exalted. First of all, the opportunity to make a film was a pretty heady opportunity, and then of course to be together with old friends, Fred Coe, who was the producer of it, Paul Newman, with whom I'd worked previously in television, and to be able to do a nice, modest little Western that had a quite different slant to it than conventional Westerns had had up to that point.
Did you feel that you and Newman took risks with his performance?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, what kind of risks? What were you
doing?
Well,
we went from the sort of basic, tight-jawed, laconic Western hero who said yup and up to somebody who was engaged in other kinds of interpersonal relationships, and they were visible in that film. And it, I think that was what sort of rather startled the American critics, although it quite fortunately for me, delighted the European critics, most particularly André Bazin.
There's a shot I have to ask you about. There's a scene where Paul Newman and a woman who's married to one of his friends kiss. And that scene kind of dissolves or cuts into a flame, a fire.
A fire.
And I was wondering, you know, whenever you see scenes like that in the movie, it's you wonder if it's like a literal interpretation of, yes, and then they had sex and we're not going to show it. Here's the heat of the flame. Do you know what I mean?
I'm afraid that you're quite accurate about that. You know, this was early filmmaking.
Right.
For me, and every once in a while I got a little too romantic and too poetic, and it was more than a little embarrassing.
You feel embarrassed about that shot now?
Well, it's evidence of somebody who was just finding out what the medium could do. I was very intoxicated by the medium of film, having come out of live TV where we didn't have the opportunity to edit and prepare scenes and so forth, and then to be able to make a film.
Right. Well, sure, you worked on Focal Playhouse and Playhouse 90.
That's right.
Had you studied the method?
Sure. You mean the acting method?
Right, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. I've been associated with the Actors Studio for 25 years.
Could you put into words how you've applied that as a director? I realize that might be too hard or too broad.
Well, in the shortest possible answer, I think it was an attempt to break stereotypes. And that's really what it was to get into some of the interior life of the characters. And that's what really we attempted to do in Left-Handed Gun, which was to take a Western and strip it of its kind of prototypical behavior and begin to get it down to direct, recognizable interpersonal behavior.
Well, you directed both the stage and screen version of The Miracle Worker. Did you have to rethink your presentation when you moved it from stage to screen?
Yes, I did, but I wish I'd done it more so. I wish I'd done more of understanding how the cinema could do certain things for us that instead we sort of articulated in language and that wasn't necessary.
What, for instance, would you have done differently now?
Oh, well, there are certain things in The Miracle Worker on the stage where we needed to have a voice of sort of opposition in order to have an obstacle, which is really what makes for a certain kind of conflict. And in that case, it was Captain Keller, Helen Keller's father, who was resigned to her terrible fate as a child who had no hearing and no sight. And Annie Sullivan, who, of course, insisted that the child could be in some way reached or hoped that she could. Well, on stage, it was necessary to give all that language and to have scenes that did it. When we put it on film, however, I wish I'd been aware that the camera could very well have provided us with a much more eloquent version of the enormity of Annie's problem, and we wouldn't have had to quite articulate it so melodramatically as we did in the play. Mm-hmm. But that was because it was only my second film, and I didn't know what I was doing quite.
I watched that film about a year ago and was really surprised at how moody and atmospheric it looked. I had forgotten that.
Yes, well, we all have a nostalgia for black and white films, and they're really remarkable in terms of being able to evoke mood.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we all were doing many more of them.
Well, you'd like to work more on black and white?
I'm always attracted by that, yes, as a medium. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes I go and I feel as if the screens are just so brilliantly colored, you could practically get blood sugar from it.
Hmm. Do you have actors improvise much on the set?
No, not really. Not really. This is such an elaborate subject, but improvisation, as it's practiced on a lot of movie sets, is not really improvisation. It's actors writing lines on the spur of the moment, and that doesn't thrill me. Now, there are certain people who can do it, and every once in a while, they come up with some wonderful stuff. Brando does it and does it wonderfully. But for the most part, I prefer not to really improvise. On the other hand, I don't really start addressing the language of the script right off the bat either. It's just a way of sort of arriving at a scene in a much less formal manner until we're really ready to shoot. And at that point, I pretty much insist upon having the language of the script.
Mm-hmm. My guest is film director Arthur Penn, and his new film is Penn and Teller Get Killed. Your brother Irving was a acclaimed fashion photographer whose work was shown in many museums.
Is
shown in many museums, yes. And I'm wondering if there's was something in your background when you were growing up together that you think led you both to such visual directions.
Well, I would like to be able to point my finger directly at it, but it doesn't really exist. We didn't spend an awful lot of time together when we were growing up. We were just two children in a family where there was divorce at an early age, and I went off in another direction, living with other people during my childhood until I was returned to Philadelphia at the time of last year of junior high school. And that's when I sort of rejoined my brother, and we spent several years together at that point.
Do you remember the first movie you ever saw?
No, I don't, because it traumatized me. I went to see a horror film with my brother, and I ended up crouching down under the seat. I remember that. It was in some theater on the east side of New York. And I didn't then go back to films for years.
Because you were so afraid from this movie?
Yes.
Did your brother remember what the movie was?
No, we no, we were both very young. I must have been 5, and he was probably 10 at that point.
So when was the next time you went back?
Well, it wasn't until I was an adolescent in Philadelphia, and I began to then be able to go to films with some pleasure, and then finally when I saw Citizen Kane, that was really the turning point in terms of gratification from film.
Well, looking back now, as an adult and as a film director, what does it say to you that this movie, whatever the movie was, had such an impact on you that you were terrified and wouldn't even go back into the theater? I mean, what does it say about the power of movies to you?
Well, there's no doubt about the power of movies. It's what in certain circles they call a counterphobic reaction, I guess, which is you get frightened by something and finally you decide, instead of staying frightened by it, you join it. And that seems to have been what turned out to be the case in my life. But I had never anticipated it. I never anticipated being in film. I always was drawn toward the theater as an adolescent.
Would you like to scare children with your movies?
I certainly wouldn't.
Okay.
I think the films that we're seeing nowadays are much too scary. I think they're terrible, actually. I think that the degree of violence in them and the basic simple-mindedness of the plotting seems to me to be appalling. Practically every other film is about some renegade cops who have to go out and get these big bad guys. But it's sort of simple-minded. I could wish at least for the Western to come back. It was a nice morality tale, you know. These are not even moral films, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. So, really, it's the artfulness and morality of the violence that
attracts me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's something eloquent to be said about that, not necessarily in always involving violence. I have a nostalgia for films like The Miracle Worker, you know. I would like once in sometime in the foreseeable future to go to the theater, film theater, and see something which was genuinely enlightening. Even a very good love story. There are far too few of those. We got all those macho executives out there doing macho films, and I think maybe we need some more feminine touches in the choices of material.
Director Arthur Penn speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1989. Penn died Tuesday in New York. He was 88. Here's music from Arthur Penn's film Mickey One, featuring Stan Getz on saxophone. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In 1951, Hank Williams was one of the biggest stars in country music. He was also a pitchman for Mother's Best Flour and Farm Feed, a company that sponsored a daily 15-minute radio show on which Hank and his band performed some hits, some hymns, and featured him joking and plugging the product. These shows have only recently been released in a 15-disc set called The Complete Mother's Best Recordings. Plus, rock critic Ken Tucker says it offers a rare glimpse of a legend at work and play.
The Millers of Mother's Best Flour bring you that lovesick blues boy, Hank Williams.
I got a feeling called the blues. Oh, Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and sigh. Oh, Lord, good Lord.
The Millers.
These days, Hank Williams is enshrined as the poet of country music, the man who established the classic modern country music myth and body of work, a spangled, grimly grinning performer who sang about hard times both romantic and economic. But the Mother's Best recordings tell a different story. Here is Hank Williams, the working musician, an ambitious young man who strove to make his immense creativity seem as tossed off as the banter with which he engaged the people in a recording studio in Nashville.
We're feeling good, Louie, and you're feeling good, so that makes it unanimous. That's it, huh?
Yeah.
Unanimous. We got a unanimous song to start you with this morning. Nikia D, fellas. Sad story. Just when I needed you. Just when I needed you, you left and went away. You made my life so blue both night and day. You left me here behind with a troubled, worried mind. So broken-hearted too, just when I needed you.
A typical Mother's Best program consisted of five parts. An intro by announcer Louie Buck, over which Hank sang what was then his biggest hit, Lovesick Blues. After his opening remarks, frequently some byplay with Hank teasing the band about everything from their haircuts to how sleepy they all were at 7 a.m., Williams would launch into a country song, usually one he'd written or a cover of someone else's. Then there'd be a live commercial for Mother's Best Flour and Farm Feed, followed by a gospel song or hymn. Then there's another song that was often a familiar standard of the time, such as On Top of Old Smokey. And finally, some closing remarks and a musical exit. Williams and his band did this live in the studio, or more frequently, since he maintained a brutal touring schedule, recorded in advance when he was traveling the country.
Dust on the Bible. Let's go. I went into a home one day to see some friends of mine. Of all their books and magazines, not a Bible could I find. I asked them for the Bible. When they brought it, what a shame. All the dust was covered over it, not a fingerprint was plain. Dust on the Bible, dust on the Holy Word, the words of all the prophets and the sins of our Lord. Of all the other books you'll find that none salvation holds, get the dust off the Bible and redeem your poor soul.
Spread over 15 discs, the complete Mother's Best recordings could have used some editing. Hearing the same intro and the same snatch of Lovesick Blues redone scores of times is a few score too many. And Hank's generosity in having his wife Audrey sing during a number of these sessions reminds music fans once again that love isn't just blind, it's also deaf. But there's a lot of priceless material here, all of it accompanied by a superlative band led by the great steel guitar player Don Helms, then a scant 24 years old.
It's called If You Mind Your Business, You Won't Have Time to Be Minding Mine. If the wife and I start fussing, brother, that's all right. 'Cause me and that sweet woman's got a license to fight. Why don't you mind your own business? Mind your own business. 'Cause if you mind your business, then you won't be minding mine. Oh, the woman on a party line's a nosy thing. She picks up her receiver when she knows it's my ring. Why don't she mind her own business? Mind your own business. 'Cause if you mind your business, then you won't be minding mine.
One of the great things about this set are the unguarded moments in which Williams gives us little glimpses of his sense of humor, and even better, his sense of craft. Listen to the way he covers another writer's song, I Can't Tell My Heart That, and gently criticizes its flat vocal rhyme construction when he finishes.
Oh, I can't tell my heart that you are no good. I'd give this world if only I could. You cheated and lied, then you left me flat. Oh yes, it's true, but I can't tell my heart that.
That's a good one.
You left me flat. Don't know where you're at.
Can't tell my heart that.
The Mother's Best box set, which includes meticulous comments on every performance by the Hank Williams scholar Colin Escott, is too repetitive to replace one of the many good greatest hits collections available. But if you're a hardcore fan, it's packed with great moments. 2 years after making these recordings, Hank Williams would die of a heart attack in the back seat of a car taking him to his next concert. The Mother's Best collection reminds us that the man who came to symbolize tortured genius and who's been stuffed into the live fast, die young cliché with many rock stars, well, he was a loose goose, a commercial shrewdy, and a generous genius as well.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hank Williams, the complete Mother's Best recordings, plus. Published last May, Ben Mezrich's The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, A Tale of Sex, Money, Genius, and Betrayal, painted an unflattering and controversial portrait of Facebook inventor and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. It's quietly become a much-anticipated movie called The Social Network, directed by David Fincher from a screenplay written by West Wing creator Aaron Sorkin. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
David Fincher's fast, entertaining, deeply cynical business saga, The Social Network, tells a disputed version of how Harvard student Mark Zuckerberg invented the web phenomenon Facebook and became the world's youngest billionaire. To Fincher and screenwriter Aaron Sorkin, it's a story that has little to do with Facebook itself and what its ascendance means to the culture. The title is either a misnomer or ironic, since the film Zuckerberg, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is emotionally paralyzed, given to betraying his friends. It's a bitter joke that he'd be the one to create a tool to facilitate friendship. No, the story Sorkin and Fincher want to tell is about a guy who creates an online social network with no social skills whatsoever to get back at a girl who dumped him and some WASP elites who wouldn't invite him to join their Harvard club. The obvious conclusion is that only a culture rooted in greed could lionize this vengeful nerd. I find that message both depressing and, based on what I know of Zuckerberg's life, unconvincing. But the film's hard sell is difficult to resist. Sorkin's dialogue spritzes out so fast, it's as if the characters want their brains to keep pace with their processors. They talk like they keyboard. The first scene is a tour de force, a dialogue between Zuckerberg and his girlfriend Erica, played by Rooney Mara, that's done at triple speed in long takes. Zuckerberg rattles off his resentment at being ignored by Harvard's elite study clubs, places, he says, that actually bus in attractive college girls with the come-on party with the next Fed chairman. As the scene escalates, Erica picks up on the impossibility of this guy loving anyone and ends the relationship. And as the movie has it, that's the turning point in Zuckerberg's life. He goes back to his dorm room, gets drunk, and blogs about Erica's bust size and the likelihood that her family changed its last name to sound less Jewish. Then he hacks into the university's intranet and devises something called FaceMash, in which Harvard students will have the opportunity to rank female students' pictures against one another. When his roommate, Eduardo Saverin, played by Andrew Garfield, returns, Zuckerberg asks for help in building an equation for FaceMash.
Hey, Mark.
Eduardo.
You and Erica split up.
How did you know that?
It's on your blog.
Yeah.
Are you all right?
I need you.
I'm here for you.
No, I need the algorithm you used to rank chess players.
Are you okay?
We're ranking girls.
You mean other students?
Yeah.
You think this is such a good idea?
I need the algorithm.
All right.
I need the algorithm.
Give each girl a base rating of 1,400.
The Social Network has a tricky structure. Fincher leaps back and forth between the creation of Facebook and a deposition room, where a now wealthy Zuckerberg is being sued by two parties, the 6-foot, 5-inch twin championship rowers Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, both played by Armie Hammer, who claim he stole their idea, and by Eduardo Saverin, who put up $19,000 but was shut out of later profits. Director Fincher has likened the film to Citizen Kane, his protagonist becoming at once more successful and more alone, ending up with, like, zero Facebook friends. Fincher gets the details right, the energy drinks, the alcohol, the programmers with their headphones deep in their antisocial trances, and he captures Harvard's oak and crimson ambiance. But I could sense the actor's panic as he cracks the whip to get them talking faster and faster. This is anti-method acting, with no time to plumb the psyche. Only singer Justin Timberlake comes through with a nuanced performance as the sleazy former Napster co-creator whose hustle is just what Facebook needs. My larger problem is that Fincher's worldview is so sour and curdled. There's no hint in the film of a positive social network, only of a world in which losing a few friends is a small price to pay for becoming a billionaire.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Actor Tony Curtis died Wednesday at his home near Las Vegas at the age of 85. Born as Bernard Schwartz in the Bronx, Curtis became a classic Hollywood leading man. He earned an Oscar nomination for his role as an escaped convict in the 1958 film The Defiant Ones. And he's remembered for impersonating a female jazz musician in Some Like It Hot. Tony Curtis visited Fresh Air in 1991 to talk about a reissue of the epic film Spartacus, in which Curtis played a slave boy who joined a rebellion against the Roman Empire. The reissue of Spartacus included footage that had been cut from the original because of violent or sexual content. Before we hear Terry's interview with Tony Curtis, let's listen to one of the scenes which was restored in the reissued version. Here, Tony Curtis's character is attending to his master, a Roman general, in the bath. Curtis gives his master a robe, then the master, played by Laurence Olivier, fills his slave boy in on the realities of captivity in Rome.
That boy is Rome. The might, the majesty, the terror of Rome. There is the power that bestrides the known world like a colossus. No man can withstand Rome. No nation can withstand her. How much less a boy? There's only one way to deal with Rome, Antoninus. You must serve her. You must abase yourself before her. You must grovel at her feet. You must love her. Isn't that so, Antoninus?
Laurence Olivier addressing the Tony Curtis character in a reissued version of the 1960 film Spartacus. Terry asked Curtis to describe the part of the scene that was cut from the original.
The scene has Larry Olivier and I in a tub. And I'm his slave and I'm washing him. And he tries to convince me to have probably a homosexual relationship with him. And after the proposition, I disappear and join Spartacus' forces. So that is, in essence, what that scene is about.
Yes, except it's very metaphoric. The whole thing is so...
Well, he doesn't come out and say, I want to stick it to you, dear. I mean, you know, he talks about snails and oysters. It's a clever way of... they think it's an artistic way of doing it. I would have much preferred the scene were a little more blatant in its approach because it would have been a lot more logical and perhaps a lot more realistic. But somebody thought it would be kind of fanciful to talk of... fish. I really don't know why.
Well, I actually have the script from that scene in front of me, so let me read some of it. I won't pretend like I'm you or Olivier.
Well, please.
But Crassus, played by Olivier, asks you a bunch of questions. He asks you, do you steal, Antoninus? And you say, no, master. And he says, do you lie? And you say, no, master. And he says, have you ever dishonored the gods? And you say, no. He says, do you refrain from these vices out of respect for the moral virtues? And you say, yes. Then he asks you if you eat oysters and if you eat snails. And you say that you eat oysters, but you don't eat snails. And he asks you if you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral and so on. And then he confesses that he eats both.
Yes.
It's kind of like swinging both ways subtext here. So did you and Olivier really talk through the scene before you did it? You
know, absolutely not. There's nothing to talk through. There I am in a bikini.
Yeah, you're wearing your bathing trunks.
Standing over him while he sits in a bikini in a tub. I mean, it doesn't really take a lot of internal dialogue to describe or even know what's going on.
Was there a big fight with the censors over the scene?
No, there wasn't. I don't think the studio had any plans to really put it in, you know?
Well, whose idea was it to put it in?
Well, it had to go in. Larry Olivier and I wouldn't have done the other scenes had not that scene been shot. See, it was written in the script, and before the picture was made, they decided that it's not going to end up in the movie. So we shot that scene, but only on the protest. Larry and I told the production department and the producer of the film that we would not be interested in doing the second scene unless we had that first scene. And we wouldn't do that first scene unless we had the scene before it where he sees me in a lineup and says to me, your name, you will attend to me. All of those were implicit in this kind of string of the relationship between Crackus and Antoninus. That's what you call complete movie making. It was very important. And for them to cut that scene out hurt that whole center of the film, and I feel it hurt the movie completely, because it kind of, you know, washed it down to nothing, so you weren't quite sure what that meant.
So did either of you take the lead in objecting to the scene being cut, or in insisting that
no, we both knew what the relationship between Crackus and Antoninus was, and we both insisted that the scenes had to be done the way the script was written. So we got them to shoot that scene, but they never recorded the sound. You know, they discarded the sound because they knew that it would probably never be in the film. Larry and I hoped it would be, and when we saw the final cut and realized they had cut it, we knew that, it was hurting the performances, but there was nothing we could do about it. And here we are 30-some-odd years later, and it's back in the movie. And I'm sure if Larry were alive, he'd really be happy to know that.
Did you need any special training for this Roman epic?
Nothing more than doing push-ups.
Did you have to make those muscles bulge just
a right.
little bit
in more? Yeah, right. In fact, when the picture started, Larry came up to me and said, Tony, where do I get arms like that? I said, come with me, sir. And I took him behind the stage. I said, get down on the floor, which he did. I said, now do like I do. Push up. So I gave him a series of push-ups to do. We do them every morning together. That's one of the fondest memories I have on that picture. Larry and I doing push-ups in the morning.
Do you remember any of the logistical problems in the big battle scene?
Yes, there was a scene that was shot in Death Valley, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember now the exact location, where down in the valley were thousands of soldiers and men lined up, and the camera panned up and came up a hill. And as it came up a hill, it disclosed, Spartacus on a horse. And just as that camera came there, the horse bolted and took Kirk off in a big steam of sand and dirt, and was never seen again in that shot. So we had to go do it again. It was really a complicated scene, and that horse just would not, you know, pay attention to it. Because after all of the action, the camera would slowly pan and disclose that horse. So it had those kind of problems, you know. Charlie McGraw, an actor who was doing a scene with Kirk Douglas, and he was the, what would you call it, the guy that ran the gladiator school. He and Spartacus, when they revolt, had a fight. And in the struggle, Kirk pushed his head, Charles McGraw's head, onto the edge of the barrel and split his eye open. You can see it in the movie, just blood gushing out. So that held up for shooting for a long time.
Oh, you mean he really hurt him accidentally?
Yes. So there were always accidents like that. I had hurt my tendon on the film, and at one point I just couldn't walk, so they gave me a cast, and I tried to, you know, maneuver through that, which worked all right. Let's see what else. Oh, there were a number of these things, a lot of horses falling down with people on it, people getting broken arms. But, you know, that's the nature of the profession, and we were all kind of prepared for it. We rather liked the adventure of it and the danger of it, you know. It all adds to the making of a movie.
The way Spartacus was cast, all the Romans were played by British actors.
Yes.
And all the slaves were played by
Americans.
Americans. Not only Americans, a lot of ethnic Americans were in there, too.
Yes.
What was the rationale for that?
I think they did it, in retrospect, you see, I feel it was probably done with an intent that aristocratic clipped English sound sounded, was in a way itself masterful, that kind of language looked down on anybody else and everybody else. And by casting most of all the slaves with Americans, you saw that very distinct difference between the two. And I think that helped in some of the scenes, you know.
It probably played on American stereotypes, too, of, you know, the British being Because the comparison was made between the British and the Romans, you know.
Yes.
More high
yes,
culture.
But that's been going on for a long time in films, you know.
Right.
Every
right.
time you needed someone who seemed to have a higher elevation intelligence, they always seemed to cast Englishmen. Or that kind of a clipped sound, you know.
Mm-hmm. You've been in several other period movies and period epics, including Terrace Bulba. How did you like doing period movies? Did you have mixed feelings about some of them?
No, I didn't. I love every movie I ever made. I've done every conceivable kind of movie. I've played a woman. I've played doctors, lawyers. I played a child in a movie. I've been football players. I've been pilots. I've been in the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. So I've played a great number of different kind of parts and people. So I love them all.
Tony Curtis speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1991. Curtis died Wednesday. He was 85.